out if you wanted to go to see one of the prisons on your own, that that's fine, but we'll try to arrange at least hopefully one tour of Stillwater and maybe Oak Park Heights, as long as they're right next to each other or close to each other. So the question is whether we want to bust and go together, or if you want to just meet out there, and we'll just figure out those logistics. Also, an announcement, January 25th, the Law School for Legislators is at William Mitchell. I really would advise you to go, members of this committee. I have a commitment on that day, but I've gone in the past. It's really worth your while, whether you're a lawyer or not, and I am not, but it really is, they really do a good job. It's worth it, especially for people on this committee. So if you could RSVP, those folks can figure out how many people are going to be coming. Okay, with that, we're going to hear about our different probation systems in the state of Minnesota. It's a complicated issue, and there's a set presentation here from our three systems. And then the final part of the agenda today is an overview of reentry services. So, Commissioner, let you sort of organize this. One more thing, just sorry, Commissioner, I just wanted to draw your attention. You should have this in your packet. Do you have this? I wanted to see if it got in there. Yes, you do. It's called The Power of Incentives for Performance, and I'm not putting you on the spot, Commissioner, but when you got up there, I thought, well, this is what I wanted, something I wanted to talk about. But I don't know that we're going to be able to make massive changes in the departments that we're that we have fiscal oversight over. But this gives you an idea. Read this article when you can. But it really talks about a dilemma that's happening nationally as well as in the state of Minnesota. And it's something perhaps, I don't know if you want to address it today, Commissioner, or any of the probation representatives want, if they would like to. But it is this idea that when there are these technical violations that are occurring in our counties, there is a trend. And if you look at the statistics that the Department of Corrections puts out, we're seeing upwards of 38% of offenders being returned back to the Department of Corrections, which is quite costly. And this article, I think, that was in Governing Magazine, talks about how they call it performance incentive funding, where the counties actually get more money from the state if they keep the offenders, whether that's treatment or they keep them on probation longer or other incentives to keep them. And we used to have this, some of you remember the battles a couple years ago over short-term offenders, where we used to reimburse the counties for keeping offenders longer. But this is a major cost driver for the state of Minnesota. And so I'd like us to be thinking big picture and whether we can do this year or plant some seeds in the administration's heads about ways of doing things differently. I hope that we can start thinking in that way, because I don't believe that there are any sacred cows in government, and there's always opportunities for efficiencies. And this article is a good read. So, with that, Commissioner, thank you for coming.
Mr. Chair, committee members, good morning. Thank you for inviting us again. I'd like to make a few opening comments and then bring our probation partners up with me here, and I think we will have a good discussion, and hopefully at the end of this discussion the committee will have a good understanding of how correctional services are delivered in our communities. I first wanted to start with the notion of what probation is and give you some idea of scale. Probation is the most common court disposition imposed in Minnesota. We tend to think, and I mentioned the sentencing guidelines, that every person sentenced in Minnesota, or a vast majority of offenders that get sentenced in Minnesota for a felony violation, end up in prison, or a good portion of those people do. And actually only 25% of all felony sentences end up being committed to the Commissioner of Corrections. That means that, and that's male offenders, and only 10% of female offenders end up going to prison for a felony conviction. What that means is that our county partners and those providing probation and correctional services in our communities are taking up the vast majority of the task for imposing and carrying out sentences. So just in terms of scale, and you may have heard from the sentencing guidelines folks already, but there was about 14,000 felony sentences in 2012. 3,400 males and 263 females were sent to prison. So the local dispositions and the availability of local resources is very important in the administration of justice in Minnesota. As a condition of probation, and for those folks that don't go to prison, there are often local sanctions imposed, and some counties have only jails, other counties have workhouses and treatment centers, and my partners that will be sitting with me in a moment here will talk about some of those resources available. In addition to our felony sentences, there are also a substantial number of misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors supervised all around the state, again, probation being the most common disposition. Sometimes there's confusion in the terminology around parole and supervised release. In the olden days, when I started as in my career, parole was the description, and still in many states, parole is used to describe the portion of time supervised on a sentence after prison. Probation is the notion that it is a probationary sentence immediately following court. So that's the biggest distinction between probation and parole. In Minnesota, felony offenders serve two-thirds of their sentence in prison, and that's pursuant to the Minnesota sentencing guidelines. They finish their sentence one-third in the community, supervised by a corrections agent, either employed by the Department of Corrections or by our community partners. If an important notion around that remaining third of time, and this sometimes this gets a little complicated, but very simply, on a 30-month prison sentence, for instance, the offender does 20 months in prison, 10 months on parole, or what's called supervised release now. If they violate that supervised release in the ninth month or the eighth month, they only go back to prison or experience a sanction for that two remaining months. And when I started and when parole was indeterminate, the sentences were 0 to 5, 0 to 10, and there was a big variation in returns to prison. There was a big variation in the parole time. With the sentencing guideline structures we have it now, it's a determinate sentencing. So we only have that person for 30 months. At the 30-month mark, they are released and they go on with their lives. The three basic delivery systems are noted here, and local jurisdictions have options on what level of services and what delivery systems they can choose to provide in their jurisdictions. We handed out the backgrounder report. It should be in front of you. It's entitled Correctional Delivery Systems. It goes into some detail. And on the back of that is a map which shows the geographic locations of those delivery systems. And I'm not going to take too much detail from my community corrections or county partners here, but some of our discussion today will be based around this map and how services are delivered. The Department of Corrections, our department, is responsible in some way, shape, or form for all community supervision. We coordinate with our county partners. Community Corrections has a partnership in the counties noted on their first page. And we also have partnerships and oversight to some degree with the community corrections agencies, which provide the bulk of community supervision in our state. About 75%, if I recall, of community supervision is provided by Community Corrections Act counties. The Community Corrections Act counties involve our major urban districts, and they can stand alone as counties, or they can be a combination of counties as well. Minnesota Department of Corrections provides adult felony supervision in 55 counties, and in 27 counties, juvenile and misdemeanor supervision. County probation officers formed under the CPO statute provide services to juvenile and misdemeanor offenders in 28 counties, and 32 counties are formed under the Community Corrections Act, and there are 17 jurisdictions currently formed under the CCA. Again, we have the map that shows the location of those jurisdictions, the brown color being the partnership counties. Where we
have any staff here that can turn that off or do something? If you have your cell phones on, please turn them off. Totally. That's not.
The delivery systems have been formed under the statutes, and the sites for those statutes are located on the bottom left of the handout. We have some copies of those statutes available, and there's significant detail in those statutes, and we are prepared to talk about some of those today, but obviously with the limited time we have here today, we won't be able to go into great detail.
Commissioner Roy, maybe you can help me. So, because you've been around the system for a long time, you probably don't go back quite.
Oh, yes.
Well, maybe you do. Maybe we both do. I guess I don't understand. I understand the role of DOC, but I'm not. Is it cost effective for us to be having three different systems, in your view? And I know there's a little bit of politics here too, but and geographical differences, but is it, in your view, is this cost effective?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the chair certainly jumps to the question immediately. Return on investment is something that we are definitely prepared to discuss in great detail. Philosophically, I believe that the delivery of services that we have in Minnesota is as efficient as, and we can demonstrate its efficiency, not only in terms of our incarceration rates, in terms of the money spent on corrections, and based on my relationships with the formerly as a Community Corrections Act director, now as commissioner, I believe that this system has some characteristics that may need attention, but I would say philosophically overall, you can be fairly confident that, I can say you can be greatly confident that we are delivering a very high level of correctional services at a very reasonable burden to the taxpayer.
And Commissioner Roy, do you know that other states have like three systems, three delivery systems for offenders?
Mr. Chair, committee members, probably the most common configuration for correctional delivery is that traditional state departments of corrections are only responsible for prisons, and the parole function is sometimes separated from the prison and probation system, and some states have a combination of those three things, probation, parole, and prisons. The Community Corrections Act, which we were in the olden days that you previously referenced, we were first in the community corrections business, and other states have modeled their community corrections divisions pretty much on our model. But the old model of prisons being separate is probably the most prevalent in this country right now. When I sit with other commissioners around the country, they are somewhat amazed that we have such a comprehensive system under one umbrella, but really three delivery strategies. We think it's a model that lends itself to reentry. It lends itself into continuity of care from prison into the community. If we, and when other states talk about their reentry challenges, they often cite the commissioner's responsibility
for
prisons.
Is it people's cell phones off? Even in the audience, you need to turn your cell phones off. I don't know if that's causing the problem. Could be budget cuts. We don't know, but it's better now. Please continue.
So there's a variety of delivery systems around the country, and I couldn't sit here with any confidence today and say one model emerges as the most prevalent.
Okay. Well, we'll have further discussions on that, Commissioner Roy. So are you, do you have more slides you want to?
Only in terms of the numbers, and these are included. Again, this gives you some level of scale. I mentioned that our CCA, Community Corrections Act partners, supervise the bulk of offenders in our communities. We, as the Department of Corrections, contracting with counties or on our own, supervise this many, but it's a tremendous number of people in our community under supervision, which means we have fewer people in prison.
One moment. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have some questions regarding to the misdemeanor, the folks who are on probation for misdemeanors. So is it better for me to ask the other testifiers?
Mr. Piquet is behind me, and he's an expert on that issue, and I would suggest that he direct his
comment. Yeah, well, hold on.
Mr. Chair.
Again, in terms of the total numbers here.
I think one moment, Commissioner. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick, on one of your slides, you had the different ones, and felony handled some, misdemeanants some. You didn't mention gross. Are gross included in the misdemeanants then, or with felonies?
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe this slide answers your question in terms of the gross misdemeanor supervision.
Not by numbers, but which of the three systems handle them?
It varies, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Roy.
Representative. That's supervision. That supervision varies in all agencies to some degree handle these gross misdemeanor supervision. Some county probation offices have taken this on, and our state officers do as well. So, Mr. Chair, I know you are interested, and we were directed to talk about three major areas that kind of cross all delivery systems, and we've labeled those the mission of our agencies, what the service focus is, and what the issues and trends are. Mr. Solheid, Steve Piquet, and Mitch Christensen will be making this presentation together, and I would defer to them at this point.
Very good. Thank you. welcome to the committee. If you can introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Ron Solhay, Deputy Commissioner of Community Services for the Department of Corrections.
Welcome.
Steve Bequay, Chisago County Court Services Director, representing MACPO.
And I'm Midge Christensen. I'm the Director of 6 West Community Corrections, and I'm representing MACA.
Okay,
With that, I'll go ahead and get started.
Please, Deputy
Department
Commissioner.
Of Corrections Field Services. Essentially, our mission is that of our agency's mission, which is reducing recidivism by promoting offender change through proven strategies during safe and secure incarceration and effective community supervision. I'm here to speak about the effective community supervision under the Department of Corrections. As noted earlier in the slides, our service focus really is the 55 counties in which we provide services throughout the state of Minnesota, and that's all of the felony services in those 55 counties. And maybe to answer some of those other questions about how that breaks down is the 28 of those 55 counties we provide for misdemeanor, adult misdemeanor and juvenile supervision. And in the remaining 27 of those 55 counties, we have our partners in the county probation ranks doing the adult misdemeanor and the juvenile supervision. So that's how those 55 counties break out. The remaining counties are CCA counties where all supervision for those offenders are provided under one jurisdiction. A distinction, and maybe that gets to some of your issue around efficiency, is that in 75 of these counties, the Department of Corrections provides intensive supervised release services. The reason for that is just that, efficiency. Some of these counties have very few offenders on intensive supervision. So in an effort to be responsible with resources, we take on more of those counties because we have adequate resources when we group those offenders in geographic areas. So it makes sense that we take on more of those offenders in those counties. Whereas in the larger CCA jurisdictions, where they have significant numbers of offenders on intensive supervised release, the counties essentially are given a grant to provide that intensive supervised release services, and again, it's in an effort to be efficient with those supervision of those offenders. Our mission, again, we are focused on providing effective community supervision, and we do this in the Department of Corrections through the use of a continuum of care or a continuum of supervision with offenders that are on our caseloads. We utilize risk needs assessments to assign agent caseloads, and typically the caseloads are broken out with intensive supervised release and enhanced sex offender agents supervising our highest risk offenders. And then medium and lower risk offenders are assigned to traditional agents and or group supervision agents who have higher caseloads because their contact standards are lower than those of the intensive or high risk offenders. Research tells us to target offenders presenting the highest risk for the greatest number of our resources, utilizing evidence-based practices, programs, services, and interventions. And that's essentially, I believe, what all three delivery systems are doing. Corrections agents receive extensive training in the use of evidence-based tools, such as motivational interviewing, COG skills programming, case planning, and are trained to conduct numerous assessments for the services that we direct our offenders toward: CD, sex offender, gambling, mental health screening, in collaboration with local service providers at the local level. Agents also conduct investigations and studies. It's part of their job, part of what our mission is. So as example, victim impact statements, plea pre-worksheets, pre-sentence investigations, transfer investigations, bail evaluations, out-of-home placements for juveniles are a few of those types of investigations and studies that our agents do in the communities where we work. This is in addition to ensuring public safety through face-to-face contacts with offenders in their homes, at their places of employment, and in our offices. So directing that the orders of the court for conditions of probation or supervised release are followed. Agents utilize many tools to ensure that offenders are accountable. We utilize drug testing, electronic monitoring, GPS tools, along with direct face-to-face supervision of offenders to ensure accountability. as far as getting into the trends and issues with what we're seeing in the counties in which DOC operates, and I think to a certain extent statewide, the number of offenders on probation and or supervised release are becoming fewer. As you can see, there has been a drop in the numbers over the last few years, but we're also seeing that our capacity on our intensive supervised release and our enhanced offender agent caseloads is pretty much there at the top. We are essentially at capacity with those highest risk offenders that we're providing supervision for. As more offenders are released to longer terms of supervision, we anticipate that this will continue. We're seeing more and more sex offenders on supervision longer, in some instances lifetime supervision on intensive supervised release. So those caseloads are a concern for us. The other thing that I think we can talk about with the offenders that we're supervising is that chemical dependency treatment, sex offender treatment, medical mental health services, along with housing, transportation, and employment, are all in short supply in many of the counties in which we operate. The DOC operates in a number of rural counties. So these services are, in some instances, either difficult to come by or non-existent. So we struggle with making sure that offenders get treatment and services that they need in some areas of the state. I think recently another thing that has been taking place is that we're seeing more specialty courts. The courts are going in to try to address mental health issues. Drug courts, veterans courts are all out there and to some extent implemented in various areas throughout the state. And we're seeing some positive results with those courts. But one of the things I think to keep in mind is that they're often very resource intensive. They require a lot of staff time by agents and or law enforcement to help manage those courts. So I think that's something that we're seeing as a trend across the state. And with that, I will turn it over to, I believe, Midge is next with Community Corrections Act.
Thank you, committee members, for allowing us a brief amount of time to talk about corrections from a CCA perspective.
Can you introduce yourself for the record just so we have this down forever and ever?
Mr. Chair, my name is Midge Christensen. I'm the director of 6 West Community Corrections. We have 4 counties and a joint powers organization, Chippewa, Lacaparle, Swift, and Yellow Medicine. So we're in the far west central portion of the state. And my agency is also a member of MACAC, which is the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties. So as the commissioner spoke earlier, we have 17 jurisdictions in MACAC representing 32 counties. We're supervising approximately 75% of all the offenders under community supervision in the state of Minnesota right now. The beauty of the Community Corrections Act, what it does for counties is that it allows us to provide correctional services in a manner that best meets the needs of our individual jurisdictions. It's not a one-size-fits-all model. No two counties are identical, and no two offenders are identical. And so what CCA supervision looks like in my area might differ from the needs of Duluth, might differ from the needs of Rochester. Because we are responsible for all of the offenders under CCA, from juvenile petty offenders through to supervised releasees, we're involved in numerous initiatives in the counties. For instance, up in Tri-County, which is Crookston, they've decided that the model that fits best for them is that their CCA jurisdiction operates the jail, operates probation, operates juvenile detention. In my area, our commissioners locally have decided that we needed to focus on juvenile out-of-home placement. So we partnered with our other stakeholders in the criminal justice system, and we went very strongly into circle sentencing initiatives, which have dropped our out-of-home placement dollars by over $300,000 a year in a couple of our counties. In fact, Chippewa County last year had the lowest rate of out-of-home placement in the entire state. Down in Rochester, CCA has allowed that jurisdiction to develop community supervision models for sex offenders and domestic violence offenders that have been modeled throughout the state and throughout the nation, actually. So CCA allows us to work as an extension of county government and to meet priorities for our offenders in our community. A couple of things I wanted to talk about with regard to reentry. We have a unique relationship with the Department of Corrections in that under the statute, we actually act on behalf of the Commissioner of Corrections in supervising those offenders as they transition from the prison to the community. So how that works is that the caseworker submits a plan out to the local agent in the jurisdiction where the offender wants to reside. It's our responsibility to check out that plan, see if it's a valid plan or if there are things that the residents that might be an unacceptable risk for that offender to reside there. And that might be access to victims. It might be presence of drugs or alcohol in the home, access to firearms, or there might just not be enough support for that to be a valid plan. So the other thing that the agent needs to do is identify what needs there are of that offender, and that includes sex offender programming, chemical dependency treatment, mental health services. Once the agent checks out the plan, if it's a valid plan, then we recommend acceptance of the plan, but ultimately it's up to the Department of Corrections Hearings and Release Unit to approve that plan and set the conditions. And then we work in that relationship for the lifetime of that supervised release case. Violations go back to a hearings and release officer to work with us on finding acceptable alternatives. So oftentimes we'll look at restructuring that offender rather than committing them back to the institution. But Mr. Solhai touched on the issue that being able to restructure an offender and not return them to the institution is based not only on risk to public safety, but the ability to serve that offender adequately in the community. So out in rural Minnesota, for instance, we have no halfway houses. We don't have access to sex offender treatment in a manner that oftentimes meets the needs of our offenders. So a lot of times we don't want to revoke somebody to the institution, but if there are no viable alternatives in our community, then we don't really have much of a choice. But I assure you that both with the felony probationers and the supervised releasees, we go through many, many restructures and attempts to divert that offender to a more acceptable behavior prior to either committing them to prison or revoking that prison sentence. A couple of other things I wanted to touch on from the perspective of CCA. One is an initiative that we have been working on that's, I know, important to this committee, and that is evidence-based practices. We have really committed at MACAC in the last year to working together to make sure that we are implementing best practices statewide at a level that meets the appropriate manner and some fidelity and quality assurance standards that are nationwide. So we've developed a continuous quality improvement plan. All 17 jurisdictions have agreed to this plan. We're going to be reporting the same outcomes. We're going to be meeting the same nationwide minimums that are acceptable as far as cognitive skills programming, motivational interviewing, case planning, those types of things. So we are all working towards the same goal, reporting the same outcomes. We realize that it's important in order to reduce recidivism statewide that we are all working towards those things in the same manner. The other thing I wanted to talk about is a trend that we're seeing, and Mr. Solhai touched on this, but when you look at the overall numbers of probation and supervised release, they are in some areas dropping over the last couple of years, the overall numbers under supervision. But we've been experiencing that the felony level probationers are not dropping at the same rate as the lower level offenders, particularly misdemeanors and juvenile supervision. In my area, for instance, we used to sit about 2007, we were at an all-time high of about 850 offenders on any given day under supervision. Now we've dropped down to about 700 on any given day, but the offenders that we lost were petty misdemeanors and juveniles. Our juvenile caseloads were cut in half. And what we lost were minor consumptions, curfews, those type of offenses. Over on the misdemeanor level for adults, property offenders, misdemeanor DWIs, et cetera. What we are experiencing little change in, and in some areas growth, is high-risk offenders. The supervised releasees coming out of prison, and also our sex offender caseload has gone up a great deal. And also the risk of those offenders is increasing. So we're being asked to supervise offenders who are a higher level of reoffending, higher risk to the community, but the resources to address their needs are sometimes decreasing or not even available to our communities.
I have one question then, Representative Hillstrom. So the so when you say resources, is that from your county budget for probation, or is that a lack of state funding to augment your services, or a combination of both?
I think it's a combination of both. Under the Community Corrections Act, you can use the state CCA funds to do programming, but in all reality, for a number of our jurisdictions, our CCA funds are tied up in staff, and we've cut staff. We've cut the equivalent of four FTEs over the last 10 years in my own jurisdiction. So we're focusing a great deal of our money just on the supervision aspect. Chemical dependency funding, mental health treatment funding, sex offender funding, that all comes from the consolidated fund, for instance. Most sex offender funding is provided through grants from the Department of Corrections that go to the providers. But out in our area, the offenders are also responsible for a fairly hefty copay. And the closest sex offender treatment we've got is in Wilmer or Marshall. So we have offenders who are driving an hour and a half one way just to get to outpatient treatment during the week. So it's a combination, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. So this is a broader question about your misdemeanor probations. So I would assume that many of your low-level misdemeanors that you used to be supervising are because more of them are on the payables list, and so folks are paying the fine, and then they're not on probation. Is that correct?
Ms. Christensen.
That's correct. Another thing that we have done is we have a supervision continuum, just as the Department of Corrections does. So we have enhanced supervision for the highest risk offenders all the way down to administrative supervision, in-group supervision for the low-end offenders. We really worked with the courts in focusing who needs our attention the most and not putting those low-end offenders on supervision for lengthy periods of time simply for us to monitor payment of the fine or those types of things. So we have tried to weed out as many offenders as we can to focus our time on the high-risk people. But as I said, the issue we're grappling with is that the risk of those offenders continues to grow, and their severity level continues to grow. So we've had to swap out, yes, we have less numbers overall, but we've had to swap out that age of time for spending more time on the higher risk folks.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in your area, do you have to put offenders, those low-level offenders, on probation if there is restitution that is owed? Do they have to be on supervised probation if restitution is owed?
Ms. Christensen?
I will caution by saying that varies greatly around the state, but in my area specifically, when the court system switched to using civil collections, we have a lot of offenders when it gets strictly to fine or restitution that they're owing, that the court will send the remaining financial obligation to a civil collections agency, and then we are able to either put that person on an administrative level, or we can send supervision back to the court to monitor payment of that. But that is not the same throughout the state.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you put low-level offenders on supervised probation, and maybe, I don't know if your area puts more of the folks who have to pay restitution on supervision, don't they have to pay a supervision fee in some areas, like $300 or something like that? And if you stop having those folks on supervision, does that then also diminish the funds that you have to supervise these higher level offenders?
Ms. Christensen.
Again, I would say the practice varies around the state. In our area, we really have tried to work with the courts so that we don't have a lot of offenders on who are strictly owing restitution. They will have other conditions, such as AA, aftercare, those type of things that we're managing. But the issue of supervision fees, some counties have a one-time supervision fee, some counties have a yearly supervision fee, but I believe it would be accurate to say for most entities around the state, if someone is under supervision, they're paying some form of a fee. And if they are sent back to court, then yes, you're correct. The supervision entity of corrections would not be collecting that fee any longer.
Mr. Chair, one final question.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be possible to find out who is doing a great job like you are in getting those low levels off supervision and who maybe has higher levels of those folks still on probation across the state, or is that data not available to us?
Ms. Christensen.
I guess I would defer to Mr. Solheid or the Commissioner of Corrections to answer that question.
Mr. Chair, we members of the committee, we have some information. There have been some surveys done on supervision fees, who's charging what, and it does vary across different jurisdictions, specific to each agency. The DOC has one set of fees that we charge across all 55 counties. But as far as delving into how many are being moved off of supervision to caseloads where maybe they aren't paying a supervision fee, I don't believe we have that data readily available. I can check into that and get back to you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify what I'm looking for. I'm actually really more interested in who's on supervision that really is there for restitution and who's on supervision in these low levels because they need things like treatment and maybe domestic violence counseling. I'm just really trying to separate out those, you know, low-level thefts that's on probation because they owe Walmart $20 versus those that are committing domestic assault or DWI.
Deputy Commissioner, you can provide that.
We will see what we can come up with for. I understand your question. We'll see what kind of information, but typically that's as directed by the courts. So we aren't able to regulate that. It's up to the court, up to the judge to determine whether or not they're actually on probation and what those conditions are, and the decision of whether or not they're just paying a fine or a fee and not on probation is up to the judge. So I think that might be a little difficult to do that, but I'll see what.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the next speaker here is Steve Pecoy with Chisago County Probation Officers.
Good morning.
Mr. Pecoy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you for inviting us. I'm here to talk about the county probation officer system. I'm here representing MACPA, which is the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers. As said earlier, we have 27 county probation officer counties in the state. We're authorized under Minnesota Statute 244-19. County POs are appointed by the courts and then approved by the county board. So we've got two levels of supervision going here. MS 244-19 also talks about our authority and duties as well. Core services are supervision and rehabilitation of offenders, providing information recommendations to the courts, working in the community to support and promote programs and efforts to prevent crime and rehabilitate offenders. Our clients in our system tend to be all the juveniles residing in the county and kids who might have been transferred in as they've moved into the county. We do all adult misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor sentenced in the county, and then again if they're transferred in or out of the county as well. We also provide bail evaluations to the court for every morning for in-custody hearings, and we provide pretrial supervision in most counties, and in some counties we also do a pretrial supervision for felony cases as well. Our focus tends to be adult repeat DWI cases. We also focus on domestic assault cases. Several of the counties have special programs, and some have specialty courts for these types of cases as well. We also supervise all of our high-risk juvenile kids as well. And again, as has been stated earlier, we have a continuum of supervision for all of our cases. We typically, the counties are, our system is funded about 70% of our operations is county levy, and about 30% of it is state. We get our state funding through two systems. One is the county probation officer reimbursement. And then we also have another funding system that's used in the other counties as well, and that's the probation caseload reduction grant system, and that was started back in about 95, and all the counties in the state participate in that. We have some strengths of our system.
Can I just ask you to explain those two things again?
Okay. The county probation officer reimbursement is situation in our counties where the probation officer's salary and fringe are paid by the counties.
Okay.
Reimbursed the next year by the state, depending on the appropriation. And the same is true for the other 28 Department of Corrections contract counties, except they pay the state immediately and then get the money back.
So when we start getting into the Deputy Commissioner, when we start getting into the budget books, is that going to show up as a grant made by the state to CPO counties?
Representative Kimmer, Chair, it does show up in our budget as pass-through monies to the counties. There are subsidy monies that go to CCA and then CPO, and then there are what we call non-competitive grants, which are caseload, workload, felony supervision, sex offender supervision grants. That does show up in our budget.
Are those numbers based on caseloads, or how are they determined?
Mr. Chair, those are based upon the CCA funding formula, which is used to determine what those dollar totals are, and that's based upon a variety of court filings, number of felons, number of misdemeanors, gross misdemeanors. There's a variety of information that goes into that formula to come up with what each
I knew this was far more complicated than you all let on. Okay, so please continue.
Okay. Some of the strengths of the systems that we're accountable to both the county boards and the courts, we work at the pleasure of the courts, and the county boards control our budget, so we have two masters. We've also developed positive working relationships with our county agencies, law enforcement, school treatment providers. We also tend to focus on local needs, and we have the freedom to act quickly. In some of the counties, we've set up specialty courts. We've set up intensive supervision programs, pretrial services. Counties are also strong supporters of the evidence-based practices, which we've talked about here already. We have people participating in training for statewide training. We make use of some of the evidence-based practices as risk needs assessments, motivational interviewing, case planning, cognitive skills programming. And again, we typically try to assess the level of supervision that people have based on a needs assessment. And there's a number of those around, and we can discuss that at some time too. But basically, we're trying to put our services where it's needed the most. So if we have someone who comes up with a high need, that person is going to be receiving a higher level of supervision. So that's kind of how we do it. And that kind of leads into another one of the trends I wanted to touch base on, is as a result of the evidence-based practices, the role of the probation officer is sort of changing. It's becoming more of some people have used the term change agent as opposed to case manager, so we don't necessarily shoot people out off the programs. Sometimes they're getting more involved with the high-level cases. We're spending more time working with them on personal issues, motivational interviewing, trying to assess what stage they're at so we can determine which type of practice would be most successful at this point in the person's acceptability, so to speak, of treatment. So it's sort of a switch. It's actually kind of a going back to when I started in the 70s. As a juvenile PO, we used to go out and sit in the house at the kitchen table and work out things. We knew all the kids. We knew the parents. We knew everybody in the family. Some of that is coming back, but again, it's only coming back on the cases that deserve and require the most attention. So we have to be careful because this is extremely labor-intensive kinds of way to go. But as was stated earlier, this is the way you reduce recidivism. So that's sort of a trend that's changing. Another thing we've noticed over the years, mental health issues with adult and juvenile offenders. As we get more involved in the families, we're running into more and more of these difficulties. Sheriff Stanek wrote a good article about adult mental health, the people being held in county jails. That comes up in our monthly criminal justice discussions all the time. What do we do with these folks? How do we find the right help? Where do we put them when they're acting out? Another thing that's coming up that we're looking at and we see work towards is the collateral consequences. There's a movement among a number of organizations to try and work towards extending the juvenile continuance without a finding from 90 to 90-day periods to 180-day periods. That might be coming up. And that's because we've recognized over the years that sometimes in that 290-day window, basically 6 months, it's tough to get a juvenile assessed and get them into the treatment and get them to complete the treatment before that mandatory 180 days runs out. So there'll be some more talk about this this year as well. And I think I'm just going to wrap up at this point.
Any questions? Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Coming from my district, I would request not using the word shoot people off.
Representative Warden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, during your presentation, you talked a little bit about the specialized courts, like drug court, mental health court, and things. And I've had the opportunity and pleasure of multiple times attending our Crow Wing County Drug Court, seeing some remarkable outcomes there. And I think I wrote down what you said, that it was we've seen some good outcomes, however it is, I don't remember if you said labor-intense or resource-intense. You know, have you done any study about, you know, if we have that kind of system that does produce results, and in my opinion does save some, is fiscally responsible and wise, versus not having that? Have you compared the two? You know, when you talk about resource intense, the other way is can be also resource intense as well. So can you compare those two fiscally, financially, you know, if we have specialized courts in the state and if we don't have specialized courts in the state?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, I know the courts have been studying the outcomes of some of those specific courts, drug court outcomes, and have been providing some reports on that. I don't believe that we have any specific studies through the Department of Corrections at this time. And my comments were specifically that they are more resource intensive. For as example, teams of drug court folks who are involved would be law enforcement, the chemical dependency treatment programs, the corrections agent. Typically, the corrections agent would be assigned to a lower caseload number in order to provide more intensive services to those clients. As far as the cost effectiveness of that, I'm not aware of any studies right now that the Department of Corrections has, but the courts have an opinion of that.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Pequay, can you just Ms. Christensen was talking about resources, and what is your counties? What are the caseloads like in your counties, and are they acceptable?
Well, Mr. Chair, they are what they are. The numbers have dropped over. I think statewide, the juvenile numbers have dropped over the last several years. I've been aware of that. Our resources, we're in a pretty good situation because we're just on the, where Chisago County sits on the northern edge of the Twin Cities. So we have access to outpatient treatment programs, and some of the things that Mitch was talking about are not an issue for us. So we're able to find vendors nearby. We have a number of domestic assault programs that we make use of. We have quality chemical dependency treatment centers around the area. So that's working out fine. As far as caseloads and things, we've lost a couple case aides over the years, and so we've had to spread around some of that. But basically what we've done is in instituting the risk needs assessments and assigning weights to the cases based on their needs and then supervision standards, I still think that's the way to go, where my POs are comfortable. They frankly enjoy working with the people more than they used to in the last decade or so, where it was more almost computer supervision. So it's a switch, okay. And we're hanging in.
Okay, we'll go to Representative Mallory, and then we'll start on reentry if you are all done. So Representative Mallory.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mine is kind of on both reentry and this. I've heard that. I think it's Texas, of all places, and a couple other states, and I think it's like Pew or MacArthur or one of those foundations have tried to do studies on not just the cost of doing more reentry and training while incarcerated versus the cost to the state directly, but also the cost to society. Could you come You probably have better access to those. Could you try to find those and get them to us if possible?
Mr. Chair, Deputy Commissioner?
Mulry, we'll take a look and see. Dr. Grant Dewey is here from the research department, and I suspect he can probably provide some of that information back.
Very good. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, I'd be interested in to see what you and Representative Hillstrom would have to say about taking a look at reducing them from three into two organizations rather than this complicated, convoluted system that we have. We looked at this for years now and wondered about it, and the commissioner, the previous commissioner, has made recommendations about doing something like that. And I'd be interested, I guess, in, you talked about a subcommittee before, looking at the three here and maybe welding it down into possibly two. Not one size can't fit all, like they say, but for some of the remote areas and the different services they have, but I think we could at least get it to two and get some uniformity, because I think a study we looked at previously showed a real difference in revocation rates and sending people back up, and get some uniformity to the whole state and get it, you know, downsized.
Representative Cornish, I've always thought that too. That's why I was a little surprised at the commissioner's comments. I think we need more information. I know I haven't been here for a couple of years, but once upon a time we had a roundtable discussion about this very issue, and I think we need to gather some information, and a subcommittee may well be appropriate for this. It's very complicated, and there's a lot of history here, but I also, if the evidence is showing that it's working, then I think we need to take a look at everything also. So,
and I think
Representative
Mulner might have been referring to that Texas model that on right on crime, they've had some meetings and talked about reducing the prison population and more people on probation and things like that. It's pretty interesting studies, and they've got quite a few of them on that Texas model.
So maybe we can enlist the help of Mr. Walz here and staff to sort of look at this issue a little bit more carefully and think about whether that's a direction we want to go, or maybe have another committee hearing on that. So, okay, thank you all for your presentations. And now, Commissioner, do you want to start off on reentry issues? And we have Mr. Kane here.
Mr. Chair, thank you again. This final slide, I think, gets to the previous comment from Representative Cornish, in that there are commonalities and they're very important. I wouldn't want this committee to believe in any way, shape, or form that there are major differences in approaches to criminal justice. And we've listed here, I think, some pretty significant collaborations that we were involved in. And we have a very collegial relationship amongst the three delivery systems, and I think we're all focused on the same mission. And it's not a contentious relationship between the systems from my perspective. I believe that there are many others in the room that would say we share more than we disagree. Moving into our next presentation, we have a pretty comprehensive presentation here on reentry and our reentry efforts. But I am also aware that the chair has invited Mr. Dan Kane, who is a very well-respected administrator of reentry services in the state and has been at this for a long, long time. And I know that the chair has an interest in hearing from him, and I would suggest that before we delve into our presentation, that perhaps we defer to Mr. Kane to
that would be fine. Mr. Kane, are you prepared? I don't know if you had a PowerPoint or if you were just going to make some points. But
I do have the right on crime Texas stuff.
Okay, great. If that could be passed out by the page, that'd be great. Mr. Kane, do you want to introduce yourself for the record?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Kane, C-A-I-N. I am the president of an organization called RS Eden, And R.S. Eden, for the past 41 years, has been providing a number of services geared specifically towards people who have made poor decisions and are trying to put their lives back together. We have drug abuse treatment. We have correctional halfway houses. We have about 400 units of sober supportive housing. We do electronic monitoring for the state. We have a drug testing lab, and we do community supervision for sentence to service work crews. Personally, I've been doing this for 40 years, and I should share that I'm also an ex-offender, having been paroled from a Minnesota correctional institution on April 12, 1972. In the intervening 40 years, I've also had the privilege of chairing the Sentencing Commission for most of the 80s and through the difficulties of the late 80s, and served on a number of other committees at the behest of this legislature. And I, in talking about reentry, I think that the first thing that, you know, we have to make clear is that prisoner reentry is not something that we do to facilitate to be nice to offenders. Is something that we do specifically to enhance public safety. Offenders who go to prison and are there, I mean, we think in terms of prison as you know, what we see on MSNBC in the evenings or what we see in the movies and whatever. I can tell you that once someone has been in prison, having prison be an inhibiting factor or the idea that it's this scary place, and it is for some people, but for the majority of people, it's a deprivation of liberty, it's lonely, it's being away from your family, and it is a tremendous waste of time. So if you assume that people who have been there are afraid of going back, they don't want to go back, but that's not something that's there. And if they can't reenter the community and find a method to get back to a level playing field, then it's already demonstrated that they make decisions that that most of us would not make. So consequently, I guess what I'm saying is public safety requires that we provide this path back to a level playing field. Offenders actually, you know, the department and the departments of probation have talked about the accountability aspect of returning to the community. Offenders really need four things, and they don't cost money necessarily, so I'll make that clear out front, to, you know, to effectively come back into the community. One, they need to change their way of thinking. And let me make it clear, I think the woman who was up here before made it pretty clear that offenders are not a homogenous group. There are, you know, there are people who have criminal thinking. There are people who were in prison by virtue of being opportunists. There are people who were in prison by being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And their needs differ, but they all need to develop some method of changing the way that they think. And by that, let me just be very brief. You know, most of us are inhibited from doing things because we know that they're wrong. You know, we've had training when we were young, and we've heard from our parents and our church and our community about what's right and wrong, so we just don't do what's wrong. But I ask you to think about the first time, and I don't know this legislature that well, but think about the first time that you swore in front of your mother. You know, you expected that she would either slap the words out of your mouth or God would come down and strike you dead. And when neither of those two things happened, it got easier to swear the second time. And the third time, maybe you used a different word that was even more egregious in the minds. And sooner or later, it became almost a pattern. Well, you know, most of us don't swear in public anymore. You know, we've learned reasons not to do that, but the reason why we didn't do it initially, because somebody told us not to, and it was going to, you know, we were going to get our mouth washed out with soap or whatever it was, that's gone. And, you know, you extrapolate that over time to, you know, to being dishonest. You know, you can talk about smoking cigarettes, drinking, smoking dope, putting a needle in your arm, stealing, and the same concept applies. You know, the inhibitions that were there to begin with are no longer there. It becomes almost a desensitization to those things. And so you have to find a way with people to help recreate that. We do that through cognitive skills training. We do that through moral recognition training. We do that through motivational interviewing and the other type of evidence-based practices that have been talked about here today. The second thing that offenders need when they come back into the community is a support system. And this is, I can't stress this enough. Offenders have a tendency to encapsulate themselves socially with people that look very much like them, to the extent that burglars hang out with burglars, heroin addicts look down their noses at meth addicts, and everybody looks down their nose at sex offenders. I mean, there's a whole pecking order in the institution. You surround yourself with people that support the decisions that you made, that do the same things that you do. You have to change that when you come out into the community. It's a very difficult thing to do. One of the greatest triggers to relapse, in my estimation, is loneliness. You know, you have a group of people who will accept you back with open arms in a moment's notice, and those are the very people that were doing the same things that you did. But you have to find people who are pro-social in their behaviors, in their beliefs, in their values, who are going to allow you to join, and it takes work. I mean, it takes work by the offender, but that's very important. The next thing that people need is they need a job. You know, they have to have a means to support themselves. They have to find a way to pay their bills and support their families. And last, they need housing. Now, there are other things that go along with that, things like family reunification, things like health care, things like whatever. But these are the things that the offenders have control over. And there are things that we try to, you know, to focus on, as does the Department of Corrections and the various community corrections, to aid people to, you know, to achieve these certain things. A number of things. One, you know, we have to make sure that our system supports the ability of people to do that. And I would argue that, you know, over the past 40 years that I've been doing that, we've become much less tolerant and much less supportive over time. Finding a job has been compromised by the fact that, you know, we now have an internet and a data system where we've created businesses where people sit down on the first floor of the government center and they log arrest records, and then they sell those on the internet for very cheap. Plus, we have our own systems that are available in the state of current of records that are here. But it's to the point where people who have a record, even if it's just an arrest record, oftentimes are extremely inhibited from finding jobs because of the data miners that are out there and the fact that their information is so readily available. The other thing that we've done is we've systematically created a system of collateral sanctions that individually, I believe, that were well-meaning, that they made sense at the time, but collectively, you know, it amounts to death by a thousand paper cuts. We made the world very small for people who want to go out there and find a job and a place to live. And this very legislature, 6 years ago, commissioned a report, and I only brought one copy that was presented to the legislature on criminal records and employment in Minnesota. There are recommendations in there in 11 different areas. To the best of my knowledge, we haven't enacted any of them. But they range from the courts to high schools to being transparent to education to diversion to licensing and background checks to really doing what Minnesota Chapter 364 says that we should do, which is basically not discriminate in hiring practices. It talks about data miners. It talks about a certificate of rehabilitation. One of the things that goes along with the internet is once something gets out there in cyberspace, it never comes back. So, you know, you can be 20 years, 30 years away from a criminal record, and it's still accessible by employers and housing people. You know, the idea behind some type of certificate of good conduct or certificate of rehabilitation is to create something that people can work towards that would basically trump that, that would say, you know, I'm done. I've done what I need to do to get back to being a contributing member in, of society and on a level playing field. That's a recommendation in here. There are several others. I'll leave it for, I'm sure that you have copies, but I'll leave it here. And it's something that works as a very good blueprint for how we can support reentry without compromising public safety. I would ask that you revisit it. The other thing that I brought today is a discussion that was a chronicle of discussion that was commissioned by the Center for the American Experiment on redemption, forgiveness, and public safety. It's it brought together a group of people that were certainly not hug-a-thug people by any stretch of the imagination. And talked about ways to effectively bring about redemption or recognize redemption and still maintain public safety. I leave it here for your benefit. Point being that if we don't do something different, we have the potential, well, actually have, you know, to relegate whole segments of the community to second-class citizens moving forward. There are currently about 23% of this population in the state of Minnesota that has some type of criminal record, either an arrest record or a conviction record. That gets higher when you look into communities of color, 1 in 3 for young African-American men. If you go into the north side of Minneapolis or the Frogtown area in St. Paul, you're talking about 3 in 4. And as we move forward, if we don't find a way to help these people get jobs, get employment, and develop a positive social structure, it's a recipe for a disaster moving forward in terms of public safety. And that's basically what I've got.
Questions?
Maybe this is a broader question, Mr. Kane, but so you provide, you're one of the nonprofits that provides reentry services, and Corrections makes those referrals, I'm assuming, and there's other nonprofit. Do we have sufficient resources out there? I mean, I guess I know the answer to that, but I.
Well, we contract with the Department of Corrections to provide halfway house services, electronic monitoring, and we do drug testing for a number of correctional facilities throughout the state. We also provide substance abuse through the Consolidated Treatment Fund. There are resources in the Twin Cities. I mean, if I were to argue, and this is personal opinion, for where we need help in the Twin Cities, it's a relaxation or a way to trump the restrictions that are out there once somebody gets treatment. Outstate, not so much. Resources in greater Minnesota are very slim, especially when you're talking about having to travel great distances. They're, you know, smaller communities will not support a halfway house economically. Treatment programs have a tendency to be in larger metropolitan areas and consequently less accessible for people in greater Minnesota. So, you know, certainly if not more resources outstate, you know, a more effective and coordinated delivery system would be beneficial.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said the services are pretty available in the Twin Cities, and yet in the area of I talk to a lot of people that are in working with people coming, well, just in reentry and later. And in view of the fact that there's estimates, probably pretty accurate, that there's mental health issues with about 70%, I'm hearing completely the opposite, that we're not treating for mental health and even to a lesser extent for chemical dependency, what's really needed to get these people straight out. And it's not just in rural Minnesota, it's right here. We're not getting the treatment to them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, the question, as I understood it, was about resources, not about access. And they're two very different things. One of the things that I think presents a problem, and I talked about coordination of services, is that it is incumbent upon the offender, who's probably the least capable of doing so, to navigate between the various services that they need. There are mental health services in the Twin Cities. Do offenders access them? Not very well. There are substance abuse services in the Twin Cities. Do they access them? Through drug court and through the orders of a probation officer, generally fairly well, but there is room for improvement. And you know, that's not to suggest that there couldn't be more resources, but really coordination of resources becomes a problem. If you have to, I mean, offenders they're homeless, they're unemployed, they're mentally ill, they're chemically dependent, they have family reunification issues. It's not any one thing. They have a tendency to be all of the above. And again, they're not homogeneous, but some combination of that bunch with needs in those areas. When you have to go and look at someone who's dressed like me when you're, you know, perhaps not dressed like this, but and perhaps not the same race, the same economic area, and fill out the same form five or six times because agencies can't share information, that becomes frustrating and people walk away. When you have to wait to get your prescription filled for your mental health medications and perhaps get it, you know, you leave jail with, I don't know, what are they getting now, a week? 3 days to a week worth of psychotropics. Finding a way to coordinate that with a community provider so you can maintain that level of stability that you develop while you're in the institution becomes a problem. So, you know, in answer to what I think your question was, I think we could use more resources, but I think coordination of resources would go a long way towards creating a much more efficient system and much better outcomes.
Maybe we can hear from the department. We're obviously not going to hear the whole reentry presentation from DOC, but that really does bring up an interesting point, because I think there's an assumption when an offender is released from prison that all of those issues, that they're being hooked up with the proper treatment programs, and I know the network was trying to make that a more of a one-stop kind of entity, and it somewhat similar to what you do, Mr. Kane, but I don't know, Deputy Commissioner, if you want to answer that. So that's really not happening. There's a case plan upon release, but who's following up? Who's ensuring that offenders are getting their mental health and substance abuse treatment?
Mr. Chair, we do have staff in our facilities, and I think what I heard the question earlier was from jails. So keep in mind that we have offenders who are released from jails at a very high number, as well as offenders who are released from prison. I think the linkages are probably stronger when released from prison, because we do have mental health release planners. We do have our medical staff who try to form those linkages, and we get into some of that as we go through the reentry programming that is available through the prison facilities. But certainly it is not a seamless system. We have offenders with very, very serious needs, and then when you couple that with perhaps it's a level 3 sex offender, who does not have access to housing because of their status as a sex offender but has mental health needs or other needs. Maybe they're an elderly offender who has needs of a nursing home type facility or more chronic care type facility. It is difficult to get those linkages in place.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would also encourage you or us to take a look at when offenders spend a significant period of time in jail or prison, they lose benefits, for example, health care and some other benefits. And so it becomes even more challenging when there are mental health issues to get them to proper medication when they no longer have access to insurance or someone to pay that bill. So even if they're stable when they're in custody, the minute they get out, it takes a while to get insurance and things of that nature to get access to a doctor and prescription medications.
Any other questions? I don't think we should start this next segment because we're out of time, but Representative Neuberger, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just be brief.
No, it's okay. We've got about five. We had a whole big presentation plan that from DOC that we're going to have to get to later, so go ahead. And
the testimonies that we've heard today have been good. They've been in-depth, but there's one question that if you could try to answer for me is how much of our population, how much of our base group are we dealing with that are transient in nature that spent time in other state correctional systems and they are now here in Minnesota? Is there a way that, do you have any data that pertains to that? I guess what I'm trying to get at here is are we becoming a repository for other states' problems?
Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberg. Actually, if you're looking at those on supervision, there are more Minnesota offenders supervised in other states than there are other states' offenders being supervised in Minnesota, at least what our records on the Interstate Compact Unit show. The Interstate Compact really regulates movement of offenders between states, and Minnesota is a part of that compact, and again, typically more Minnesota offenders are being supervised in other states than other states' offenders being supervised in Minnesota.
Very good. Any other questions? Is there anyone from the public that wishes to testify before the committee adjourns? Commissioner Roy, sorry we didn't get to the, but I do want to cover this. This is really important. So members, tomorrow we'll be talking about sex offenders and prevention and civil commitment. So see you tomorrow. Meeting's adjourned.